Hello, and welcome to Ramblings with a Medical Historian. I'm your host, Nicole Curry, and this is a podcast where I ramble on about medical history. I look at strange practices, common misconceptions, and medicine throughout history. I also talk about some interesting Canadian and local history. This is Season 3, Episode 2. Last episode, I got the seasons mixed up, but whatever. This is now Season 3, and this is the second episode. So last episode was supposed to be Season 3, Episode 1, but I made a mistake. So moving on. So being that it is Breast Cancer Awareness Month, I would like to talk a bit about the history of cancer today. Cancer runs in my family, so it is a bit of an important topic for me today. But I was actually inspired to do this episode now instead of down the road by an email I received a while back. A medical doctor and professor at the University of Ottawa sent me a copy of his book and asked if I would be interested in promoting his book. I was shocked, let me tell you. Here's me thinking that no one actually listens to my podcast other than my mom, and this doctor, professor slash author is now contacting me to promote his book. Wow, I'm very honored. So I've been reading his book and so far, amazing. It is called A Short Primer on Why Cancer Still Sucks. It is written for the layperson and the professional. Dr. David J. Stewart writes this book for everyone. Each chapter is broken down into two sections. The first part is sort of more for people with no medical background, just like going over the topic sort of generally, broadly. And then the second part sort of goes into that nitty gritty, sciencey medical details. I actually decided to read this book when I went for my doctor's appointment last month. I thought I would be waiting like maybe half hour tops. But like, you know, since it's a specialist appointment, whatever, coming from out of town. But no, I waited for 2 hours. But the good thing was that this book was really interesting and helped me, like, just help make time fly. Not only does he have a lot of interesting info, but he's hilarious and he makes a lot of historical quotes and references, which I love. So whether or not you have medical background, I would suggest looking into this book. Once again, it is called A Short Primer on Why Cancer Still Sucks by Dr. David J. Stewart. He thought this book might be of interest to you listeners, and I have to say he is right. You can get this book on Amazon, Chapters, Indigo, anywhere fine books are sold. Now, on with the episode. So, starting off with the oldest descriptions of cancer. The earliest evidence we have of cancer is actually from human remains. The fossilized bone tumors, or osteosarcomas, have been found in Egyptian mummies, though a study done by the University of Manchester showed only one case of cancer among hundreds of Egyptian mummies. Bony skull destruction, as seen in cancer of the head and neck, have also been found. The earliest known descriptions of cancer appear in different papyri, like the Edwin Smith Papyrus, which was written around 1600 BCE. There is also possibly a fragmentary text from around 2500 BCE. They contain a description of cancer, as well as a procedure to remove breast tumors by cauterization, wryly stating that the disease has no treatment. In the Edwin Smith Papyrus, I found this. So the title is, quote, necessary knowledge and skills for spherical masses on his chest. Examination, quote, if you should examine a man for spherical masses on his chest, you find they having spread on his chest, and if you put your hand on his chest on those masses, how you find it, the chest, is very cool, there being no heat at all within it, and how your hand finds it is they not being granular, neither can they make fluid nor generate secretions of water while they are ball-like in your hand. Diagnosis, quote, then you are to say about him, one who has ball-like masses, a medical condition, I will fight this. Treatment, it is nothing, / there is no treatment, / remedy. So basically saying they discovered these sort of tumors on this person's chest and they weren't really able to have any conclusive treatment with it. So this is just one of the cases of treatments for tumors. Now it is a little bit trickier for me to get copies of the papyri with the translations and all. So there's probably a few other cases of the tumors and perhaps other treatments, be it surgical or otherwise. However, incidents of cancer were rare, so there is not a lot of documentation, though other records seem to suggest there might be a couple lying around somewhere. But hopefully one day, I hope to get my hands on some of the primary documents that are translated into English so I can examine these ancient medical papyri. Now, on to the origins of the word cancer. Hippocrates is credited with the origin of the word cancer. He described several kinds of non-ulcer-forming and ulcer-forming tumors, or cancer, referring to them by the term carcinos, the Greek word for crab or crayfish. He also used the term carcinoma. This comes from the appearance of the cut surface of a solid malignant tumor with the veins stretch on all sides as the animal, like the crab, has its feet, whence it derives its name. Since it was sort of against Greek tradition to open bodies, Hippocrates only described and made drawings of the outwardly visible tumors on the skin, nose, and breasts. Treatment was based on the humor theory of the four bodily humors, so black and yellow bile, blood, and phlegm. So according to the patient's humors, treatment could consist of diet, bloodletting, and or laxatives. The Roman physician Celsus, from 25 BCE to 50 CE, translated the Greek term carcinos, or carcinos, into cancer, the Latin word for crab or crayfish. About 100 years later, in the 2nd century CE, Galen, another Greek physician, used the word onkos, Greek for swelling, to describe all tumors, reserving Hippocrates' term carcinos for malignant tumors. Galen also used the suffix oma to indicate cancerous lesions, although the crab analogy of Hippocrates and Celsus is still used to describe malignant tumors, Galen's term is now used as part of the name for cancer specialist, oncologist, and from which we derive our modern word oncology, or the study of cancer. So you have that first part, onco, which is sort of the term for cancer or whatever, and then ologist it's referring to a person who studies the cancer. And then ology is the study of. So that's the breakdown of the words, how we get oncologist and oncology. Through the centuries, it was discovered that cancer could occur anywhere in the body, but Hippocrates' humor-based theory of treatment remained popular until the 19th century with the discovery of cells. Now on to cancer in the 16th and 18th centuries. During the Renaissance, beginning in the 15th century, scientists developed a greater understanding of the human body. Scientists like Galileo and Newton began to use the scientific method, which later was used to study disease. Autopsies were done by William Harvey around 1628 that led to an understanding of the circulation of blood through the heart and body that had until then been a mystery. So in the 16th and 17th centuries, it became more acceptable for doctors to dissect bodies to discover the cause of death. So this is where we get our autopsy from. If you want to learn more about that, see my episode 5 and 6 from season 1. German professor Wilhelm Fabre believed that breast cancer was caused by a milk clot in the mammary duct. The Dutch professor François de la Beausilvius, a follower of Descartes, believed that all disease was the outcome of chemical process and that acidic lymph fluid was the cause of cancer. His contemporary, Nicolas Taupe, believed that cancer was a poison that slowly spreads and concluded that it was contagious. In 1761, Giovanni Morgagni of Padua was the first to do something which has become routine today. He did autopsies to relate the patient's illness to pathologic findings after death. This laid the foundation for scientific oncology, the study of cancer. The famous Scottish surgeon John Hunter from 1728 to 1793 suggested that some cancers might be cured by surgery and described how the surgeon might decide which cancers to operate on. If the tumor had not invaded nearby tissue and was, quote, movable, he said, there is no impropriety in removing it. So basically, if that tumor was sort of like movable, like meaning like if it was like easy to like access or whatever, like cut around, yeah, just remove it. So this is probably not going to mean like removing any tumors like in the head, like brain, but like just easy tumors that you might have. They were already removing them in the 18th century. The first cause of cancer was identified by British surgeon Percival Pott, who discovered in 1775 that cancer of the scrotum was a common disease among chimney sweeps. The work of other individual physicians led to various insights, but when physicians started working together, they could draw firmer conclusions. With the widespread use of the microscope in the 18th century, it was discovered that the quote, cancer poison eventually spreads from the primary tumor through the lymph nodes to other sites. This is what we refer to as metastasized cancer or cancer metastasizing. It sort of spreading throughout the body to other systems, other parts, etc. This view of the disease was first formulated by the English surgeon Campbell de Morgan between 1871 and 1874. The use of surgery to treat cancer had poor results due to problems with hygiene. The renowned Scottish surgeon Alexander Munro saw only 2 breast tumor patients out of 60 surviving the surgery for 2 years. Now on to cancer in the 19th century. The 19th century saw the birth of scientific oncology with the use of the modern microscope and studying diseased tissues. Rudolf Virchow, often called the founder of cellular pathology, provided the scientific basis for the modern pathologic study of cancer, as Morgani had linked autopsy findings seen with the unaided eye with the clinical course of illness, so Virchow correlated microscopic pathology to illness. This method not only allowed a better understanding of the damage cancer had done, but also aided the development of cancer surgery. Body tissues removed by the surgeon could now be examined and a precise diagnosis could be made. The pathologist could also tell the surgeon whether the operation had completely removed the cancer. In the 19th century, asepsis improved surgical hygiene, and as the survival statistics went up, surgical removal of the tumor became the primary treatment for cancer, with the exception of William Cooley, who in the late 19th century felt that the rate of cure after surgery had been higher before asepsis, and who injected bacteria into tumors with mixed results. Cancer treatment became dependent on the individual art of the surgeon at removing a tumor. The underlying cause of his results might be that infection stimulates the immune system to destroy the tumor cells. During the same period, the idea that the body was made up of various tissues and that in turn were made up of millions of cells laid rest the humor theories about chemical imbalances in the body. Now let's look at sort of some of the mechanisms involved in cancer. So the genetic basis of cancer was recognized in 1902 by the German zoologist Theodor Boveri, professor of zoology at Munich and later in Würzburg. He discovered a method to generate cells with multiple copies of the centrosome, a structure he discovered and named. He postulated that chromosomes were distinct and transmitted different inherent factors. He suggested that mutations in the chromosomes could generate a cell with unlimited growth potential, which could be passed on to its descendants. He proposed the existence of cell cycle checkpoints, tumor suppressor genes, and oncogenes. He speculated that cancers might be caused or promoted by radiation, physical or chemical injuries, or by pathogenic microorganisms. Now let's move on to some of the therapies. When Marie Curie and her husband Pierre Curie discovered radiation at the end of the 19th century, they stumbled upon the first effective non-surgical cancer treatment. Not saying that radiation is necessarily good, but it is a treatment of cancer, one of the two biggest that we have right now. With radiation also came the first signs of multidisciplinary approaches to cancer treatment. The surgeon was no longer operating in isolation, but worked together with hospital radiologists to help patients. The complications in communication this brought, along with the necessity of the patient's treatment in a hospital facility rather than at home, also created a parallel process of compiling patient data into hospital files, which in turn led to the first statistical patient studies. Cancer patient treatments and studies were restricted to individual physicians' practices until World War II, when medical research centers discovered that there were large international differences in disease incidence. This insight drove national public health bodies to enable the compilation of health data across practices and hospitals, a process found in many countries today. the Japanese medical community observed that the bone marrow of victims in the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki was completely destroyed. They concluded that diseased bone marrow could also be destroyed with radiation, and this led to the development of bone marrow transplants for leukemia. Since World War II, trends in cancer treatment are to improve on a micro level. The existing treatment methods standardize them and globalize them to find cures through epidemiology and international partnerships. In 1968, Michael A. Epstein, Burt Achong, and Yvonne Barr identified the first human cancer virus called the Epstein-Barr virus. The beginnings of the modern era of cancer chemotherapy can be traced directly to the German introduction of chemical warfare during World War I. Among the chemical agents used, mustard gas was particularly devastating. Although banned by the Geneva Protocol in 1925, the advent of World War II caused concerns over the possible reintroduction of chemical warfare. Such concerns led to the discovery of nitrogen mustard, a chemical warfare agent, as an effective treatment for cancer. Two pharmacologists from the Yale School of Medicine, Lewis S. Goodman and Alfred Gilman, were recruited by the U.S. Department of Defense to investigate potential therapeutic applications of chemical warfare agents. Goodman and Gilman observed that mustard gas was too volatile an agent to be suitable for laboratory experiments. They exchanged a nitrogen molecule for sulfur and had a more stable compound in nitrogen mustard. A year into the start of their research, a German air raid in Bari, Italy, led to the exposure of more than 1,000 people to the SS John Harvey's secret cargo composed of mustard gas bombs. Dr. Stuart Francis Alexander, a lieutenant colonel who was an expert in chemical warfare, was subsequently deployed to investigate the aftermath. Autopsies of the victims suggested that profound lymphoid and myeloid suppression had occurred after exposure. In his report, Dr. Alexander theorized that since mustard gas all but ceased the division of certain types of somatic cells whose nature was to divide fast, it could also potentially be put to use in helping to suppress the division of certain types of cancerous cells. Using that information, Goodman and Gilman reasoned that this agent could be used to treat lymphoma, a tumor of lymphoid cells. They first set up an animal model by establishing lymphomas in mice and demonstrated that they could treat them with mustard agents. Next, in collaboration with a thoracic surgeon, Gustav Linskog, they injected a related agent, mustine, the prototype nitrogen mustard anti-cancer chemotherapeutic, into a patient with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. The patient, a Polish immigrant to Connecticut known in literature only as JD, received his first injection on August 27, 1942 at 10 a.m. The doctors observed a dramatic reduction in the patient's tumor masses. Although the effect lasted only for a few weeks and the patient had to return for another set of treatments, that was the first step into the realization that cancer could be treated by pharmacological agents. The patient ultimately died of cancer on December 1st, 1942, 96 days after his first dose. Publication of the first clinical trials was reported in 1946 in the New York Times. So that is the history of cancer, or at least the early history. In the 20th and 21st centuries, we have seen great advancements in cancer diagnosis, treatment, and research. There is so much that has happened, and it is much more, it's common knowledge, I would say. To learn more about cancer and what are some of the causes, treatments, etc., be sure to check out A Short Primer on Why Cancer Still Sucks by Dr. David J. Stewart. I hope you have learned something today, and if you would like to know more or see the sources that I used, you can find them on my website that is linked in the show notes or episode description. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, you can reach me at Ramblings with a Medical Historian on Facebook and Instagram, or shoot me an email at ramblings.mh@gmail.com. Follow me on my socials to stay up to date with the episodes. Thank you for listening, and remember, keep rambling on.